so the case became famous as a kind of example of lawyers and their clients standing up to public authorities. Now there's some other examples I want to put on the table. The Irish protests against English rule stretched out over more than 100 years. And the great thing about reading the speeches in court of Irish advocates is that they have their own way of dealing with the language that wasn't their own. In terms that must sound familiar to many of you, the official language of the courts in Ireland was English. And Irish advocates were forbidden to speak in the Irish language, and indeed there had been a wholesale English prohibition of any teaching at all in the Irish language. The English had at least virtually been consistent wherever they were in the world. They forbade the teaching or carrying on in any language except English. We take yet from the Irish advocates the denunciation of the state-sponsored informer. And looking back over the speeches of Irish advocates in political cases, we find notable examples of rhetoric that is relevant even to this day. For example, there is Dan O'Connor, famous Irish advocate, who said this about an informer who was testifying on behalf of the state. I speak not now of the public proclamation for informers with a promise of secrecy and of extravagant reward. I speak of what your own eyes have seen from the box where you are now sitting. The number of horrid miscreants who acknowledged upon their own that they had come from the seat of government, from the very chambers of Dublin Castle, where they had been worked upon by the fear of death and the hope of compensation to the evidence against their fellows. Oh yes, the mild, the wholesome, the merciful counsels of this government are perched over catacombs of living death, where the wretch that is buried a man in tombs till his heart has had time to fester and dissolve, is then dug up a witness. Whenever you read lawyer talk like that, you put it under your book and say, I wish I had said that. Here's another example. If it was not known by unfortunate experience, and particularly in many recent instances, it could scarcely be conceived that such abominable turpitude could find place in any human being. It could scarcely be conceived that any being imbued with a rational and immortal soul would deliberately come forward to forswear himself in the court of justice when, if he is believed, the life or liberty of the accused will be forfeited. Look at him, he says to the government's witness. He admits to treason and proudly carries the pardon in his pocket. Yes, his pardon in his pocket, so that he will not be executed as a traitor. And for his bribe, not yet in his pocket. Yet yielding up the tie of friendship to watch the steps of his friends for the bribe of government. I have heard of assassination by sword, by pistol, and by dagger, but here is a wretch who would dip the evangelists in blood. He thinks he has not sworn his victim to death. He is ready to swear without mercy, without end. Oh, do not, I conjure you, suffer him to take an oath. The hand of the murderer should not pollute the purity of the gospel. If he will swear, let it be on the knife, the proper symbol of his profession. Well, in the first year I came to South Africa in 1988, we were in a trial advocacy teaching program based upon a treason trial. And our effort was to help to train advocates to deal with the cross-examination of informer witnesses in political cases. And our mock witness was someone who had sworn on direct examination when presented by the state that she knew a number of UNS leaders, that she had been with them, that she knew the accused, that they had been involved in running guns, and she had worked with them in that capacity. That later on she'd been arrested for her acts, and after a decent interval in Kampala had seen the light. That classic light, I confess, they did it, and they had decided to become a government witness, and in consequence of her willingness, would be maintained in an apartment in Johannesburg. Well, not very far from reality. And as I thought about the case, what struck me was the similarity between that use of informer testimony and the situation that we had very often Republicans have confronted the similarity, that is, and not the obvious difference. And so I suggested a cross-examination that would be designed to point out to the presiding officer the weaknesses in that testimony, designed to permit the advocate to argue that at the end of the day that there ought to be a reasonable doubt that the state had not borne the onus of proof if all that it could summon up were witnesses who had been put through that kind of a process and who had come to court with that kind of experience in case custody. And so I tried a cross-examination that sounded like this. I don't remember the name of the witness, but his ex began, "Of what country are you a citizen?" South Africa. "Will you tell his lordship, what is the penalty for treason in your country?" "Death." "Will you tell his lordship, please, whether it is so that in your examination in chief, you admitted doing a number of acts that if you were convicted of them, would result in your being sentenced to death?" "That's so." "Now, I want you to look around the courtroom and tell his lordship who in this courtroom has the most to say about whether you will be prosecuted for that offense that carries the death penalty." "That's the prosecutor, isn't it?" "That's the one. That's what I'm questioning." "Well, all right, now we understand that. Will you tell his lordship, please, whether he wants to be put to death?" "He said no." "Now we understand that. Now, it's also the case, when you were first arrested, you denied to the police that the accused here had anything to do with running guns. Is that right?" "Sure, yes, I did. But that, yes. And you denied that you had anything to do with running guns, right? But now you're here to tell us that that was a lie." "Yes." "So his lordship, when you denied that you were running guns, you were trying to protect yourself, weren't you?" "Yes." "So now, his lordship, I understand that you are someone who will lie to protect herself." "Yes." "And at the time you were arrested, the accused were your friend. Yes." "And you lie. You now say." "Yes." "So his lordship, I understand you also lie to protect your friend." "Yes." "Well, so that we don't have any doubt, who is your best friend in the world?" "Well, I don't understand the question." "Well, I said, if one of the accused of you were in an airplane that was going down, there was only one parachute, who do you think should have the parachute?" "He says, well, I do." "Well, that's because you're your own best friend, right?" "Yes." "Well, now, since that, I noticed you're very well dressed today." "Well, thanks." "And you live in an apartment in Johannesburg." "I do." "Who pays the rent?" "It's my mother's apartment." "I didn't ask that. Who pays the rent?" "My mother pays part." "Who pays the rest?" "Well, the state helps me out." "And were they helping you out when you were telling them that neither you nor the accused had done anything against the law?" "No, they weren't." "They started helping out afterwards." "Yes." "You do deny that you lied for money, don't you?" "Well, yes, I deny." "All right, well, now what's the problem?" Studies movement in the United States, which some of you may have read. And for those who asked those questions and raised those, this is my comment about that subject as well. Those members of the critical legal study movement in the United States who say that the actions of advocates in courts don't make any difference because talking about rights is inherently indeterminate. Well, based on the examples that I've given, I want to make a claim about the role of the advocate in court and about the rhetoric of the advocate who talks about rights. When an advocate stands up in court and says, "Your Lordship, I contend that the accused in this case must be acquitted because the state has not borne the onus of proof," or, "I contend that the state should not be free to offer this item of evidence for this, that, or the other reason," or, "I contend that the accused in this case were simply exercising the ordinary rights of a citizen," what is the advocate doing? Now, I'm very conscious of the fact that there is only one entrenched right remaining in the South African Constitution, and I think that is the right to speak English or Afrikaans, as you wish. All that aside, there are certain statutory provisions and certain common law provisions that supposedly confer on the accused certain things that are called rights. When the advocate stands up, in my view, the advocate does not, by going to court, admit the legitimacy of the state apparatus, does not admit that the apparatus of rights as declared is adequate or would be adequate for some future form of society, nor does he or she admit by standing up in court that whatever judgment the tribunal might eventually render is going to be good or going to be proper simply because the tribunal renders. What is the advocate doing? Well, let's focus on criminal cases because those are easy. The criminal defendant doesn't have any choice about whether he or she is in court. Arguably, if you bring a civil case, you're asking the state for something. Maybe there could be an argument about that. The criminal defendant doesn't have any choice. In my view, what the advocate is doing is three things. He or she is persuading, measuring, and predicting. Persuading. Judges swear an oath to uphold the law. There's going to be a lot of judges that have a lot to answer for in the next life by having taken that oath, but I'm not going to do that. The judicial function in bourgeois society is exercised by people who are nominally independent of the system of social relations. And sometimes those judges really do try to find the open spaces in the law and enforce them. Sometimes those judges can be persuaded. We all know of cases in which there's been an acquittal or a denial of some application by the police or this strange decision by the appeal court on the kidnapping of someone to come and stand trial in South Africa, invoking a principle of international law that, with South Africa having accepted it, only the United States and Israel denied that it's there. So that was sort of a surprise, but it was judges that applied a rule. Now, how did they decide to do this? They decided to do it because the advocates in front of them were talking about the rule in a persuasive way. Not as supplicants. "Oh, please, Your Lordship, will you do this? Come on, Your Lordship, get it right." No, indeed. They got it because as advocates, they were prepared. They were thorough. They were persuasive in the ordinary sense of that word. And I have a feeling increasingly that they embodied a certain notion or ideal of justice that the judges, or some of them, feel that without the periodic honoring of which they themselves would have to see that they become delegitimized. On this view, a
statute or a decided case or a common law principle is nothing more nor less than a promise that the regime makes to the people. And the advocate's attitude, as he or she stands up, is not that that promise is enough, not that it's a particularly good promise, not that it's some future society, some other kind of promise doesn't have to be made, but that that is a promise and the advocate is here to collect on. Thus the advocate persuades, but maintains that critical stance that's necessary for the other two parts of Wright's rhetoric. In order to be able to persuade, one has not only to be prepared, in the sense of having the academic training and research and thorough consultation with clients that's necessary before you go into court, but I don't minimize the fact you also have to have a certain amount of courage. The advocate who is prepared at all times to go into court and persuade on behalf of the oppressed is going to have to take some risks. I'm here to tell you, I think there's some satisfaction when the risks pay off. There, and the taking of those risks brings a kind of contentment of its own. But there are risks. The memorial lecture last night, and the reason that it was called a memorial lecture, underscores the fact that there are risks. So the first function of the advocate is to persuade. And Wright's rhetoric, talking about rights in that sense, persuades. The second function of that rhetoric is that it measures. What does it measure? It measures how far the state falls short of redeeming even the promises it makes, and how far even those promises fall short of meeting the people's needs. Measures in two senses. Now, you are fortunate because you do not accept the assumptions upon which the state rests its power. You question those assumptions. You can't use Wright's rhetoric to measure unless you stand someplace from which you question the dominant assumptions of the state. What do I mean measure? Well, let's take the first sentence. Measure how far the state falls short. You have a special role as an advocate. I began to suggest that tonight. That special role is to represent the people, to represent your clients. Your clients, many of them, are not even mildly aware of the rules and the statutes and all of that. For them, the court, the place where you do your work as an advocate, is a distant, forbidding, objectifying, discredited place. Well, probably is all of those. It certainly is all of those, especially if you're accused of the doctrine. But you at least have the key. You have the right audience there, and you can stand up and translate this reality for your client and attempt to mediate. So the first job of measuring for you as the lawyer is to say, wait a minute. For example, there is a procedure by which a confession of an accused is supposed to be made admissible. The procedure of getting the confession, going to the magistrate, and doing all those things that are set out in the criminal procedure law. And yet, I have enough experience in South Africa, only having been here on three occasions and having read a number of decided cases and talked to lawyers, to know that that procedure is often a farce. That police misconduct is rife, and that the magistrate procedure is often used as a cover-up for what happens at court. You, as the advocate, have the vital job of measuring, of standing up in court and persuading the court how far short the state has fallen of keeping its promise with respect to the confession of the accused, but also to say to your client immediately and to the mass movement more broadly how far the state has fallen short. Because you, with your skill and training, are the only people who can do that kind of measure, who can point out the gaps between the promises the regime has made to the people and its actual record of performance on those promises. sort of fancy name. But whenever you write a book, you have to think up names for things. You hope it's reviewers and get them, and you'll sell more books. And it did work out for me in that way, but I still like the way that I describe it. This kind of measuring has to do with your sense of what must be done. You go out to a township. You go out to one of the so-called homeland. You go into any inner city. You can see what task lies ahead. You can see how difficult those tasks are. You can see that the passing of a statute and the pouring in of some money simply would not solve the difficult problems having to do with people's expectations, needs, and desires. So you start the process with a little humility about what the law can do. But you can also see that there must be changes, and that those changes must be reflected in a new set of promises that a state constructed on new principles will make in a free and democratic South Africa. The content of those promises and the carrying them out is inevitably the job of lawyers who have listened to the needs of the people. But inevitably, lawyers are going to be involved in that process. So, how do I describe that as measuring? Might do it this way. That today, we have, you would say to your clients, succeeded or fallen short by this much in winning this litigation under present law for our trade union group client. You know, we've done as much, the law has given us, the present law has given us as much as it can. And your clients will stand around and say, well, that's not very much. Now, some lawyers might say, well, what do you mean it's not very much? I want to know they got you everything that the law provides. Well, the honest lawyer would say, I know it's not very much. I know it's not enough. So now, we, the lawyers, and you, the people, our clients, are going to have to forge this alliance to get a new set of rules in here that will satisfy the people's claims for justice. The nature of those new rules cannot be something that lawyers go up onto some tower and talk to other lawyers about. It's all very interesting to sit around with other lawyers and talk about things that a year or two ago, you know, were strange. Have you noticed when you go back to people in your family that aren't lawyers and start talking about all the things you've learned in law school, how they look at you like some alien has taken over your body? Because you're saying all these things. It happens, I think it happens every place, right? Well, that's a reminder to lawyers that we ought to forget in whose interest we're supposed to be lawyering. The job of thinking about the future is not a job that we lawyers can do all closeted up with ourselves. No, indeed, it's one in which we work with our clients who are going through this process of making claims for justice that the system is not satisfied, to see what a new set of rules might look like. Look, the third way in which rights rhetoric, you're talking about rights, could be helpful is that it is predictive. This is related to the second kind of measure. That is, the lawyer who is involved with clients in litigating on their behalf, standing up in court and arguing, must try to describe what a newly constructed society might look like. A society that paid attention to people's needs. Again, that is the debate that's going on today in South Africa. And the discussion that started out last night, I shared a few thoughts about it, is only a small part brings us to see a ways down the road. But to repeat what I said by Stein, none of us deceives himself or herself in the belief that we can anticipate every zig and zag in the process of historical development. None of us deceives themselves into thinking that the other side, the reactionaries, aren't going to be battling back in that dialectic. There's going to have to be some adjusting and learning and trimming of sails. But in the broad outline, we can predict. And with respect to a minimum program of claims for justice, the minimally acceptable set of demands that are now being made and that are going to be made in the future, we can surely have some confidence that our training and experience as lawyers equips us if we'll just listen to represent our clients. This notion about the relationship between struggle and daily work is one that has been borne out again and again and again. And every society in the process of change faces not only these wonderful opportunities that lead to a sense of exhilaration, but also faces the terrible risks that in the process of formulating the new standards, the lawyers will at some point stop talking to the people and start talking just to themselves. When that happens, the lawyers are courting a terrible danger and sowing the seeds of their own undoing. It's going to be important for this generation of lawyers to read about these earlier generations of lawyers in other revolutionary situations, whether it be France, the Soviet Union, England, Ireland, or wherever, to try to heed those lessons and to avoid the temptation to move too far away from those voices on whose behalf you have persuaded and measured and predicted. Those voices whose aspirations it has been your job to translate into claims for justice that have some expectation of being satisfied. Well, that's all I came prepared to say. I thank you, and let's open it up to questions.
their voices, like this. We are not isolating themselves from the movement of the people. I mean, you don't elaborate on that, just say that players like this is their voices, but the mechanism that can be employed, that isolation doesn't make it, doesn't work. Because you find out, I mean, because of your activities or whatever, it's not that you have wish or hope that you should be isolated as a player from the community, but you find that you are more isolated because of the kind of the community. So what mechanisms can be employed to avoid such
things? That's a good question. Everybody here, what mechanisms can you employ to avoid isolation? The first is to avoid the error of a large part of the critical legal studies movement in the United States, which simply says that talking about rights doesn't make any difference, the court system is corrupt, we're going to stay away from it. And so they're not members of the bar, they don't go to court, and they encourage other, they teach this view in the law school, primarily at Harvard Law School. And their graduates listen, not sagely, and get jobs working for law firms on Wall Street. So, I don't know, I guess it sort of proves itself. You can tell that I'm mildly contemptuous of that attitude, but it really is the classic intellectual attitude, right? To sort of retreat, okay? Well, I don't really care, you know? It's the attitude that the poet Lorca, Federico García Lorca, criticized during the Spanish Civil War in a poem which in Spanish begins, "Encerraron al poeta porque lo quiero y era llano. Pero por detrás de los grises puros, hondo se oye otra cosa que llama. I have shut my balcony because I do not wish to hear the weeping. But from beyond the gray walls, nothing else is heard but the weeping." Okay. So that's the isolated intellectual. Now the second kind of intellectual isolation happens because the lawyers either came from a certain place to begin with or forget that they've got roots in the community. And that's the sort of mind game that gets played by people who imagine that all you need to do to have a good idea is just think of it. That ideas are separate from practice. Ideas are separate from reality. And that sort of isolation can lead, and here all I'm doing is talking about what other people have written, it can lead to a kind of super leftist isolation. Or it can lead to a kind of defeatist isolation. Now let me answer the practical question. How do you do it? Well, I think the way you do it is to listen to your clients. That is, it takes more time, if you're going to represent a labor group, to get out there and talk to the workers. You know? But I'll tell you something. That time is well rewarded. I can remember one of the greatest cross-examinations I ever did was of a reactionary lawyer for a reactionary trade union league. And the way that I did it was that my clients, who were rank-and-file steel workers, had read over the material and found out that this guy didn't know what he was talking about. He got so far away from the workers that he was, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. And then the next thing we did in this lawsuit was we put one of our rank-and-file worker leaders on. Black steel worker from Youngstown, Ohio. He got up on the witness stand, and we had worked, and we had listened, and we had prepared. And the other side, the lawyers for the reactionary union leadership and for the steel companies, thought, who is this? Just a steel worker. You know? And so they started asking him questions, and it turned out that he knew how to run that steel plant. Because he showed up there for work every day for 20 years. And that impressed the judge. Right? Now, what he had was a tremendous sense of nervousness about getting into the witness box in the court. We lawyers could work with that, but we never would have had these great ideas if we hadn't gone down there into Homestead, Pennsylvania, and the steel mills in Gary, Indiana, down around the steel mills in Chicago and Cleveland and so on, and talk to the people who are our clients. No? So, it sounds simple, but that, there it is. You just got to get out of the office.
protesto e de várias cases em São Paulo, 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 em
São Paulo, em I don't understand the position that someone might have saying I refuse to be tried here as a racist court. However, the experience in the United States has been that that sort of refusal has ultimately been unproductive. Because it was tried by the industrial workers of the world, defendants in the wake of the First World War, who all stood mute in their sedition trials. And it's been tried a few other occasions. And the problem with it is that it doesn't give a basis for mass organization around the racism issues and the injustice issues. Now, what do I mean by that? In other words, if the advocate goes to court every day and the accused decides to be tried in the court, the advocate can stand every day and object to the procedures that are going on. Right? Now, some cases in South Africa are closed to the public. I understand that. But where there is a public trial, which is the case in many of these political trials, I think the organizational possibilities are much greater. By standing up in the court forum every day and objecting to what's going on. Also, it may be that the judge will give a little here and there and then you'll find out more. One of the things that amazed me about a trial I sat in on Johannesburg, a very significant political trial, was that even though it was an open trial, the courtroom wasn't filled. I think that a part of that strategy has to be that every seat in that courtroom should be filled every day. So that the people can go out and describe what they've seen. You see, the lawyers are ethically bound. They can't comment on the pending proceedings, but there's nothing to prevent a person that saw it from commenting on it. So the strategy is one of confrontation. And I'll give you an example. I represented a Vietnamese anti-war, Vietnamese national anti-war activist in the United States who was charged with espionage. And it was a terrible case, I mean, in terms of the government's attitude and so on. And really hopeless case in terms of getting a complete victory. But every morning, I made sure that every morning in court, I stood up and had something to say to object to the proceedings. Something to call attention to the fact that we were being railroaded. And, and one morning, I sort of had the brilliant idea of saying, I think this case, Your Honor, is being masterminded by the CIA. And I bet there's a lawyer for the CIA here. Would he stand up, please? And a guy stood up. In the Angela Davis case, when I stood to argue that the charges should be dismissed, I knew that we were not going to get the charges dismissed at that hour. I just knew that. But I knew that the press was listening. And I knew that then Governor Ronald Reagan had appointed this special prosecutor who really looked greased. He looked like George Scott with a bad hangover, you know? I started by saying, may it please the court. I intend to show that with this man, Albert Harris, as the engineer, the Marin County Grand Jury is America's only working railroad. Now, that is not a legal argument, but that's an argument that I could make. See, the great thing about being an advocate in a criminal case is not that you're permitted to confront the state, but that you're required. So, isn't that wonderful? Think of another place in South African society where you actually get dressed up and your job is to confront the state. So, I don't mean to overdone it. I understand the position and I've debated it through with many clients and have sort of come to the view that you shouldn't lose your opportunity to do this measuring function in the act.
sniffing during the intensity of risk of their eyes, what they can do. Now, what I want to know is, what should be more important for an advocate, for a attorney, who is interested in bringing these rights to people? Should it be more important for them to see that justice is being done, or to win these cases?
Good question. Everybody has a question. First off, being just a human, personal level, I didn't get into this business because I like to lose. So I like to win. I really do. And therefore, now sometimes it happens, for example, that we'll be pleading a case that has a substantial human rights issue. And suddenly it will appear that the state has made a procedural mistake, so that we can win the case, but it will be on a technical ground. The court will not recognize our human rights point expressly. I take those. That's fine. I'll take that. Because when I step outside and I'm asked, why did you win? I'll say it's, well, the judge was not willing to publicly acknowledge the human rights point, so he chose this other one on which to base the decision, and we regard that as a people's victory. Now, I think it's a people's victory for the following reasons. First, any time, particularly in a highly sensitive criminal matter, that the state is compelled to keep any of its promises is a good thing. These so-called technical rights of procedure are not technical when the life and liberty of the accused is at stake. Second, I think it's going to happen, it has happened in the past, I'm sure, and it may be happening more frequently in the future, that judges will be inclined to reach a good result, but unwilling to state the very broadest reasons for that result. That very often happens in a transitional period, either in a progressive direction or a regressive direction. And so I'll take those victories. For example, in January, I argued the case of a young man who was 17 years old at the time he committed a murder. He's been sentenced to death. I do not believe that I can get the court to declare that it is unconstitutional, a violation of the American Constitution, to execute someone who was only 17 at the time of the offense. I have my doubts. But I want to save this life. And so I argued as a sort of alternative point that the jury, because the jury assesses the punishment, was not adequately told about the significance of youth as a mitigating factor. Right, the narrower ground, because I didn't think I could get all the way to the broader ground. During the Vietnam War, a number of people, we had our own mild version of the pass laws. If you were between 18 and 35, you had to carry a card that showed your draft status, your conscription status. And if you didn't carry the card, you could be put in the penitentiary for 5 years if you were found not to carry it. But it was a dumb law, but there it was.